This is the Urban Political,
the podcast on urban theory, research, and activism.
Welcome to a new episode of the Urban Political. Today, we're excited to bring you the first episode of a double session on the local state and its transformations. The two episodes will explore the changing forms, roles, and agencies of local states and bureaucracy in our contemporary era of polycrisis, with a geographical focus on Europe. My name is Gala Nettelblatt. I am a postdoctoral researcher at the Institute for European Urban Studies at Bauhaus University in Weimar, Germany. I have started this exchange with my colleague Matthias Naumann, geographer and professor at the University of Würzburg, also in Germany. And we are very grateful to the Urban Political team for hosting this conversation. Across Europe, local states are in a dire predicament, experiencing the consequences of austerity cuts, shortage of staff, as well as a lack of trust in government. Overlapping crises such as climate change, military conflicts and displacement, precarious provisions of public services, the production of so-called left-behind places, and the rise of the far right pose severe challenges to its institutions on various scales and across a wide range of sectors. This situation has sparked seemingly paradoxical developments. In some contexts, it has evoked the loss of legitimacy of democratic institutions and authoritarian takeover, while in other cases, the local state is becoming an arena for progressive statecraft tailored at social justice and sustainability transitions. Much is being written on these authoritarian and progressive tendencies. Here, we want to complicate binary thinking that can be quick to romanticize progressive local institutions or paint a homogeneous picture of authoritarian situations. Paying close attention to the intricacies of the local state, we want to draw attention to its inherent contradictions, frictions, and contestations by asking, how does progressivism and authoritarianism play out in the everyday processes of the local state? What are the gray spaces where they might overlap and even co-produce each other? What power relations shape these processes? The two episodes interrogate to what extent we witness the appearance of new state bureaucracies and institutions at the local level, emerging in the field of tension between progressive transformation and authoritarian takeover. Our contributors explore the contemporary manifestations of these shifts in different geographic regions, ranging from the UK over Sweden, Germany, Austria, and Hungary. To make life a little easier, the first episode will focus on authoritarian attempts to dominate local state institutions, while the second will focus more on progressive possibilities. Today's episode is moderated by Ross Beveridge, and we're excited for contributions by Harriet Dunn from the KTH Stockholm in Sweden, Theo Temple and Christian Fuller, both from Cardiff University. Enjoy!
So the first question to Gala and Matthias is, what got you interested in researching, writing about the local state?
Yeah, thanks, Ross. So the first point of departure is quite a personal one, because Gala and I used to work for a state institution for spatial development and research in Germany. And so we had a really personal experience about the pressure on the state to transform, pressures from the neoliberal side to save money, to cut, make cuts, pressure from the authoritarian side, from the far right, pressure on state institutions. And on the other hand, we were faced with the long-established German bureaucracy and the persistence of bureaucracy. And so we struggled about the question how to transform the state in a more progressive manner. And that was our starting point to think about questions of the state, of statehood, of local transformations of the state. And that was the personal background of us to get in a dialogue with the existing work and political theory, urban theory, and critical political geography to think about the state. So that was, yeah, the first point of departure to think about the state. And we discovered three issues which are most important for us, which will Gala elaborate the next couple of minutes.
Thanks, Matthias. Yeah, so I think in addition to that sort of very personal experience working in the civil service, we are, of course, also aware that the state, state formations and statehood have long been of really major interest to human geographers, but also urban theorists. And what we are really interested in is really to think through and focus on the particular shifts we're witnessing in statecraft in this very contemporary moment of transition that we think we're in. Given that, we do build, or like we're particularly inspired by sort of two theoretical traditions. One looking at the state as a strategic site of struggle, and sort of the tradition of Pulantzas, thinking about Bob Jessop's work, who really look at the state as a sort of complex field of relations also through which power flows and is as being mediated by dominant interests, but also counter movements. And that socialist tradition as sort of this state as a site of contestation and political terrain, where power, state power is something to be captured, I think is really helpful. On the one hand, but then on the other hand, also we start to be really interested to think about these struggles also from outside the state. So from a different theoretical position and sort of the more sort of Foucauldian camp that looks also at modern statecraft as something radically inadequate, really, for providing justice and sustainability. And that looks at sort of power struggles and movements outside. So against that backdrop, kind of, there's first two and then a third set of questions, Matthias, that you just mentioned as well, that we're interested in. One, new spaces within the state. So what are ways for changing the local state and its institutions from within? What experiences exist on the local level? What are prospects of progressive, but also perhaps of authoritarian transformations of state institutions? And then the second set of questions would sort of look at new spaces outside the state. So thinking about social movements and local initiatives that also create their own institutions outside of state control for providing public services, for instance. And then a third sort of set of questions that also we thought would be really interested thing to look at, but that might be something also for the next episode, is sort of methods that exist to empirically access some of these questions. I'm thinking about the state, the local state and public administrations. I think maybe this is sort of how we got thinking about the local state. And I'm really excited to have our three guests here today and hear sort of from their field work and work in different geographical contexts.
Thank you, Gala and Matthias. A fascinating agenda. But yeah, let's open it up to our guests, Harriet, Theo and Crispian. Could you let us know a little bit about how you you got interested in the state and how your work has progressed in relation to the state? Perhaps you can start with Crispian and move to Theo, then to Harriet.
That's great. Thanks, Ross and Matthias and Gala, for inviting me onto this. So for a long time, I've been doing work on austerity. I took a break for a couple of years, not least because it was so overwhelming in the UK. So we've been doing that really since about 2010. And the interest has been on how the state is reconfiguring the new spaces it was creating, how it was really trying to, on the one hand, be very quite authoritarian to enact change, but on the other hand, trying to maintain a fiscal coherence and institutional coherence. And I think that's been a long running theme both at the national level, but also at the local level, how potential crises, tensions, contradictions are managed and mediated within the state, but within the state in relation to a much broader fiscal coherence that it seeks to maintain, and not something that's just an event or a moment, but something that's constantly performed. And my interest in particular was always right down to state personnel and how these much broader spatial changes, policy changes, were being mediated by the individual. So I remember doing some work back in Birmingham back in 2015, and it was very much the things that we saw at a grand scale in terms of austerity were being mediated by state personnel on a day-to-day basis. So that was really my main interest in the state, and then that that blossomed into the role of finance and how the state was continuing, and particularly how local government was continuing in a stage of austerity. And in the UK, that's really been about council tax. And council tax is a tax on property, but it's now a big funder of local government. So, for instance, we see 5% increases year after year in council tax for people to pay. And that is becoming a huge part of the way that the state is being funded. But then it has big ramifications in terms of citizens and the increasing use of debt enforcers, the rising debt. So the debt for council tax at the moment is about £8 billion. So a huge amount of funding. In this particular project, we're really looking at how that fiscal coherence is being maintained, how potential crisis is being mediated, and all those tensions and contradictions are being mediated. Well, I'll let Theo explain a bit about Roald Jakey. That's the theorist that we're using. But it fits much broader within the approach I've taken. And as with Gala, a big influence of Bob Jessop, you know, and treating the state as a social relation and power as something that's heavily mediated by a variety of social forces. But also added to that, big influence of people like Clive Barnett and the all-affected principle, and why that's not coming through in the council tax project. I think there's a lot to be said about Clive's work around the development of local politics beyond the state. Ross as well, and colleagues around, you know, urban everyday politics as well. So that's having a big influence in how we're trying to understand those agents beyond the state, but who are seeking to work within and through the state.
Fascinating. Thanks. Thank you very much, Crispin. Theo, did you want to come in there?
Yeah. So my background, I came to sort of this interest in the local state from doing an MA in history, 20th century history. I was quite interested in the 1970s, 1980s period and the sort of so-called urban fiscal crises in North America. It's quite interesting how these macroeconomic conditions sort of land on those urban local states, and then often kind of became sort of pathologized and seen as a kind of problem of dysfunctional city governments and decadent urban life, but then also how local states then became political vehicles for certain fixes to crises. From that kind of conceptual framework, did a piece of research looking at neoconservative influence on housing policy in the New York fiscal crisis during the 1970s. So that was kind of my first like stab at looking at the local state. And then I thought I'd do something similar for my PhD research. Actually, as I was writing my MA dissertation, there was a fiscal crisis emerging in Rio de Janeiro in Brazil, just after it had hosted the Olympic Games. And I thought, okay, I'm going to do something, explore the background to that, the story behind that. But as I kind of got into the weeds with that, as you tend to do, got interested in something else, this corner of the local state finance in Brazil, funding local municipalities is the property tax system. And it's quite interesting how in this also very decentralized state, how the property tax system kind of supports limited sort of sovereignty of municipal government, and the use of sort of discretionary tax relief and tax-free zones is a way of articulating sovereignty. So I was quite interested in that sovereignty and exception work, the kind of theories around the gambling and things like that. And then more recently in this current project about council tax debt, it's interesting because it's obviously in a very and highly centralized state, the British state. But then it's in what's happening in the debt space is kind of how those local states are exercising a certain, you know, control, because they haven't got that control over the overall tax system. That's kind of broadly how I kind of became interested in the local state, in this kind of concept of sovereignty and exception. And then more recently into the context of a debt fair state in the UK.
Thanks very much, Theo. Harriet, do you want to give us an overview of your engagements with the local state, how you got into this area of research?
Yeah, happily. Thank you so much for having me, and also already some really interesting insights. So it's really exciting to be here. Firstly, I suppose I want to say I'm a planner, an urban planner by training. I was a geographer first, but I'm a planner by heart. I've kind of heard that's maybe a bit of a taboo around the urban and political geographers, but I'm out and proud as a planner. So my work being a planner is naturally oriented towards the local, so the local state. And I really like planning because it's such a material way of seeing how ideologies and politics play out. Urban development infrastructure is so tangible and changes the urban fabric so very visible that it attracts a heck of a lot of public interest. Everyone has an opinion about the spaces they move within on an everyday basis. And secondly, I suppose on a more theoretical level, I've been really inspired a lot by the work of theorists who've conceptualized the huge changes to the local state and planning practice as part of that, as part of neoliberal transformations and the associated post-politicization of planning and urban development. And I suppose building a little bit on what Crispin and Theo have been talking about, kind of the effect of these different coalescing fiscal crises and how this affects planning values and practices, and thus urban development activities and changes to the urban fabric of our cities. When we talk about, post-politicization and neoliberal spatial governance, I suppose for a long time I've been inspired by that way of thinking, but reflecting on what comes next. I mean, if neoliberalism is dead in the water, as some would claim, I mean, I don't actually think it is, what comes next? What new types of governing and governance are emerging and coalescing and merging with these existing neoliberalized institutionalized practices? And how do they seek to challenge those values and practices that are so embedded within local government as their responses to the fiscal environment that local authorities are going through? And I suppose when I talk about fiscal environment, my training as a planner was in the UK. So a lot of the reflections that I've had have come from the more British ways of thinking, kind of following more British politics. But in the last 5 years, I've worked in Sweden. So it's kind of trying to apply some of those different ways of thinking and think about how that British context relates to the Swedish context, which is where my empirical work is now. And the different types of challenges and problems, the convergences and the divergences there.
Thank you, Harriet. It's already come out in your opening remarks, and Gala raised it as well as an issue. Power is you know, one of the core themes when we think about the state, the local state. If we're thinking about how power might be captured or how state power changes in terms of its purposes, in terms of your own research, how have you identified institutional changes within the state? How have you grasped the processes internal to the state in relation to power? And I'll come back to you, Crispian, to start us off on that.
Great, thanks, Ross. It's a challenging one in the sense that, I mean, there are big epistemological issues around how you actually get to the truth, how you get to knowledge which is accurate. Theoretically, for our project, we're using Royal Yagi, and that is very much around looking at forms of life. So these are embedded social practices that seek to problem solve. That's the theoretical basis that she's working on, that there is persistence in society and through the state, through these embedded forms of social practices, essentially problem solving, and they survive by problem solving. And when they're not affected, they go into crisis. So on the one hand, it's looking at power as being able to persist, as policy in terms of being able to persist. And the interesting thing about council tax is that it's highly regressive. It's very detrimental for large sections of the population. It should be completely delegitimized. There should be massive crisis within it and protests, but yet there isn't. So there is a form of power going on, which is far more intangible and tacit, and that it works in the background, but yet doesn't. It guides people's behavior. It guides state officials who legitimize it. And it guides the population. We don't have mass protests. We have council tax, which increases year after year. So the individual is increasingly paying for the local welfare state on top of all their national taxes, and it only ever goes up year after year. Yet there is immense legitimization power working through the state and into civil society, which has maintained a very regressive taxation system in ways where there isn't major contestation. So we're trying to get to a form of power which is authoritarian, but is very embedded within social relations. So it takes us back to Jessup again, and that isn't being contested, that is able to survive and mutate and is very variable across space in terms of how it's implemented, but within a framework which is largely authoritarian. So that's what we're trying to get to. And it's, as I say, it's a form of authoritarian power which is set within the background, which is what we believe is set within these Yagian forms of life, as, you know, problem solving, as social practices which are just performed and not contested. And it doesn't mean, you know, the hammerhead of the state, you know, within overt forms of power that are controlling and that are very coercive. I'm not saying that isn't there, because it is there. But there's something else within this system which is much more powerful, and that's embedded within state practices. And one of the interesting things that we found, and Theo might talk more about this, is the fact that within the revenues and collection departments of people running council tax in the local state, they don't contest the system. They don't question it. They just think, I need to meet the targets. I need to make sure that everyone has to pay this legal obligation. And I think that's a very powerful form of power. And it's something very different from, you know, very coercive, disciplinary, in your face forms of power.
Yeah, I think the Yagian kind of angle has been really useful to sort of untangle the how this kind of internal coherence is sort of maintained. On the one hand, you know, how is the sort of content of the institutions? Yeah, how does the means meet the ends? And also the kind of process of, Yagian terms, reactualization. How have people who do this work, like reading the situation and adapting to the sort of social reality, you know, almost like, what are they telling themselves, and how are they shifting the standards in order to continue business as usual, basically? And I think, Yagi's been very useful at, like, providing that sort of conceptual framework to sort of, yeah, and as Christopher was saying, in the context of something which seems kind of absurdly not working, you know, the accumulation of counter-tax debt to 8 billion is an example of a system which isn't working by its own standards. But yeah, it continues. I think one of the interesting ways that we've looked at the change within the state is the relationships between different kind of departments or teams, functions really, of the local state, and how they've sort of changing interfaces. Certainly, part of this kind of this story of how this system is being maintained is how different functions are sort of being brought closer together in certain local authorities anyway. So like council tax teams working with benefits teams, working with different welfare teams, and sort of placing council tax debt as a sort of focus of work, trying to kind of collect different types of debt together and to kind of produce an overall picture of debt, and to try and leverage internal data to strategically direct enforcement to sort of do council tax debt collection better. And then there's this other aspect in that the local state kind of sucking in, you know, nominally external organisations such as perhaps Citizens Advice. So they are kind of more closely integrated into the agenda of the local state, to kind of take on the sort of priorities of the local state. And actually, you know, a lot of interviews I've done, people talk about, oh, you know, we used to have a lot more of an antagonistic relationship between the Citizens Advice and the local state. And I think that's really, it's interesting how this crisis is sort of being managed by sucking in an expansion, but also a kind of closer relationship between different functionally separate things. Kind of most dramatically, I mean, one of the findings I think is really interesting from this work is how the sort of crisis of the local state in terms of around council tax debt, around enforcement specifically, is leading to attempts by local authorities to leverage the central state into its enforcement problem. There's a project basically to try and get HMRC and the DWP to share data with local authorities of people who are council tax debtors, so they can kind of do enforcement against those people more efficiently, do attachments to earnings. I think that's kind of like, there's a quite a profound shift there, you know, but it's emerging in this kind of strange corner of local state financing in the council tax debt space. So I think that's a very interesting change that we're seeing within the local authority, within the context of significant constraints, as Crispin was saying.
Thanks, thanks Theo, for that. Harriet, do you want to come in on this issue of how you grasp these institutional, these internal changes and the shifts in power in your work in relation to your research?
When I think about this question, I think about it in terms of a more empirical or a more research design kind of oriented way of thinking about it. And I think I was inspired a lot when Crispian, you were talking about the different forms. That there's not been a lot of mass protest against the different types of these kind of council tax issues. And I was thinking about that idea of protest, and I suppose in difference to the type of research that you're doing, I suppose my starting point has been to find those points of protest or to find those points of internal power struggles. So look for when power is contested, when maybe you have different types of power actors coming up against each other, the different disruptions that are going on when different, we could say, ideologies or governing rationalities come into play to contest existing institutionalized practices and ways of doing something, possible disruptions in business as usual, disruptions in the different values, practices and relations, and changing relations between the different state institutions of that local state. And I suppose that's been kind of a guiding star for me in trying to identify how the local state is changing, trying to find these different points of disruption and find those parts of the local state or those local governments, and in empirical cases where I can see those disruptions or contestations starting to take place. And to give it a kind of a broader context, most of my empirical work is focused in Sweden. And I think that's a really interesting context because of this enduring legacy everyone thinks about in the, when they think of Sweden or Scandinavia, of this kind of powerful welfare state, particularly when it comes to spatial planning or development domains, which has really been rapidly superseded in recent years by neoliberal politics. And moreover, and particularly of my interest in the past years, like a lot of other countries in Europe and beyond, the massive advancement of far-right ideologies and populist ideologies, which has substantially affected the national political context. And my interest was taking that and asking how those types of contested ideologies were coming into focus on that local, the local context, how that was changing the local state. And that formed the background for me for investigating what's happening right now in local governments. So in terms of research design, I talk about investigating from the inside and the outside. So both reading those reports and trying to understand local news sites and social media and local news has been a huge source for me, but also being inside local state and inside the local governments, so doing participant observation and seeing the changing values and then the changing practices taking place because of new populist and reactionary governing regimes and the popularization of populist reactionaryism and how that is affecting the different values and institutions of planning and the local state kind of in real time.
Thanks, Harry. So thinking perhaps particularly about what is particular about the local in relation to the state, whether we think of that in scalar terms or, you know, political science talk about levels, or we want to get in spatial terms, there is something particular about the local state. And I think we've been touching on it. It might be useful to be more explicit about it, perhaps in relation to some of these broader issues. I mean, I think everyone has been pointing in that direction, but if we could be a bit clearer perhaps about what it is or how we grasp what's happening at the local level in relation to these broader processes. And you talked a lot about neoliberalism, austerity, authoritarianism. So I wonder if we could say a little bit more about how the local aspect of the state or how we understand the local in these wider processes in terms of what the state is doing. And I'll go back to you again, Crispian.
Sorry, Ross, do you mean in terms of our theorization of the local state or spatial relations?
Yeah, so starting with the theorization, how we think about the local in terms of the state. And then I wonder also, I mean, I think you said a lot already about how the local is instrumentalized in relation to austerity and the council tax. And it's a really good example of showing that. I mean, perhaps I don't know if you've been doing any research around the rise of reform or you have any thoughts on how those processes are playing out. So it's something about taking that theorization of the local state in relation to these sort of ongoing more general processes, which aren't necessarily just local.
Yeah, that's great. Thanks for the clarification. Yeah, I mean, it's interesting in the sense that, you know, you mentioned reform. I think that's probably another podcast, The Rise of the Right. And it's certainly going to be interesting in the UK with the May elections coming up, both locally, but also in Wales as well. But in terms of that local state and theorization, I suppose with the zeitgeist, theoretically, we are embedded within a conjunctural analysis and probably more of a conjunctural analysis where we aren't necessarily concerned with crisis tendencies, but moments and periods of contradiction and tensions that play out over various spatialities. So on the one hand, it's very much a conjunctural view that it's the multiplicity of various processes that come to form that variability across space that we see. So in relation to council tax, despite the top-down nature of it, we do see a great deal of variability in terms of how it's implemented. And I think a big thing about that is how the local state officials bedded within historically constituted organizational cultures are actually mediating that variability. So in terms of having to address the top down having to address these broader issues of austerity and a cost of living crisis and a UK economy which is essentially stagnant. So the tax base is going up on individuals because the economy isn't performing. They're having to mediate that, so these much broader spatial processes, at the same time as mediating what's going on locally, both politically, but also economically and socially. So we see that variability in terms of the implementation of council tax, where there is that scope in which to be less evasive, to be, in certain instances, more engaged with local people and those people in debt, in contrast to other places where they're far more coercive. We've spoken to many places where the view is very much one that's being pushed down centrally, which is it's a tax and you pay the tax. We need the money, and therefore they're quite coercive. So I think for us, then, it's a conjunctural way of viewing the state, but it's also a topological view of viewing the state as well, where there are these processes of a very topographical nation state, where that local state is situated, but also a topological one where reach and presence and connectivity is changing a lot. So we would argue that the relationship between the local state and citizens is far closer in terms of presence and connectivity because of that tax obligation. And Theo mentioned about certain pilots around being able to get access to people's work details and therefore taking their wages, a proportion of it as tax, where they've not paid. Now, that is very topological. The distance is becoming in close proximity to the state. The local state, and therefore the nation state, becoming in, you know, close proximity to the lived experience of those individuals. We would come from the approach then in terms of conjunctural analysis, but also very topological as well. And that means that space and time, you know, space-time compression to an extent, particularly for council tax, where the debtor, the citizen liable for a tax, is now within close proximity to the state, but also then they are in much closer proximity to broader processes of austerity, of a UK economy that's being stagnant. So we would argue that in these areas, there is, through this topological relationship, there is a far closer relationship between these much broader processes and the citizen.
Yeah, I was going to just add to that, that when doing this research in different local authorities in the country, it's really interesting to sort of unpick how those like local histories and the local context of the poverty, how described, the kind of poverty reduction ecosystem in those local areas, that the state within that, and how, for example, in certain areas in the north, where historic impacts of the miners' strike is still kind of present in the background, and then in other local authorities, the issue is about housing, you know, refugee families, and how these things are all kind of cross-cutting around the issue of the council tax debt. They enter into the problem, basically. The local state, how it's become articulated around the wider service provision, the third sector, the sort of spontaneous and the voluntary organisations which have popped up over the years to deal with the particular issues of poverty and populations and low income. Is it another way that the sort of the local state is articulated in relation to those things? And I would say the other thing is, Chris, we're talking about presence and how things which may appear kind of very distant can sometimes still have that presence. I mean, two things about that. Within the law, the council tax, not paying your council tax, can send you to prison. But actually, not many people have gone to prison recently. But it still has this sort of enormous effect on the debtor, the citizen debtor population that we've interviewed, the threat of going to prison. And then the kind of historical presence of the fact that the council tax emerged out of the the poll tax revolts of the early 90s. So in some ways, the kind of the lack of change that we're seeing, the deep continuity of this system, which seems to be in crisis, can partly be explained by the presence of the effect of what happened in the early 90s in terms of there being a social movement resisting payment of the poll tax. So it's been really fascinating doing this research to see how all these kind of things, which seem to be very, very distant, then get kind of located in place, but are also being managed, obviously, at the nation state level.
I see. So, Harry, how do you think about this? What's distinctive about the local state, and perhaps we're already talking about moving towards talking about social movements and contestation of the state. And you mentioned that in one of your previous answers. So perhaps you can locate that theorization of the local state within those contestations and relations to social movements.
Great. I think in some way I've been sitting here trying to work out this question. I think it's quite a difficult one, trying to understand, you know, what one is thinking about when we say the local. It's a word that we band around a lot, but I think when you try and think of it as more than just a scale of local government, it becomes quite complex. And then the way that I think about it in my work, and where I think the idea of the local becomes concretized, is within this division of various resistance movements, of various contestations. So my work talks about populism and populist resistance, and I've discussed a lot how populist resistance use the idea of the local, local community and what the local is to them, to try and build a vision of who and what both the state planning and urban development should be for. So when we talk about the connection between local and populism, we talk about there being a shared goal of restoring political authority to the community. So populism talks about this, the idea of these out-of-touch governments' failure to adequately consider the needs or desires of local residents. In a lot of my case, in my casework, I have seen a lot the rise of independent local parties who were arising to fill the void. And these types of parties really employ the idea of we are the local. They often brand themselves on we are 100% local, 100% interested in local needs, 100% devoid of any ideology, 100% local issues. And I think that's a really idea of trying to deploy an idea of local to be some sort of opposition to what they imagine as elite interests. They think about local interests. In planning language, we call it the public interest, and that's their idea of shaping around the local. And a lot of the populist movements that I've seen, or the populist movements that I've been looking at in Sweden, really employ this idealization of local and rural community life. And have these kind of social characteristics of the local that are embedded in depictions of authenticity, stability, harmony, and reclaiming power from what they see as very distant national or regional governments, and bringing power back to the local based on this particular idea of a particular identity that they attribute to the local. In one of the small municipalities that I've been looking at, which is actually only a town of 20,000 people, it's a small town in Sweden called Knivsta. There's been a huge pushback in recent years to what has been considered a very market-led, neoliberal-dominated, market rationality-led urban development regime. We saw the uprising prior to 2022 of specifically local party, Knivsta.now, they were called, who kind of branded themselves on this 100% local party, who just began as citizens who had specific grievances against this form of rapid urban development and rapid infrastructure construction that they didn't agree with. and formed as part of this local party, and eventually in 2022 actually took power in the local government and worked to change the regime in accordance with this kind of populist reactionary vision of what they wanted to preserve and protect about the local. The local is not only important as a kind of visioning object, but there's a strong importance of the local state. So interestingly, in regards to kind of this idea of ruptures and changes within the local state, there's a lot of research indicating that authoritarian and very far right populist regimes fundamentally threaten the future of the local state, well, the state in general, but we're speaking about the local state, especially when planners or other government professionals are positioned as part of this elitist enemy. So we see a lot of the deconstruction of various institutions associated with that, those authoritarian regimes of populism. But I would say that within the populist vision, even in these more right-wing forms, there is some imagined future for local government, precisely because it constitutes a space to politically affect. So while, of course, populism does constitute a real threat to local government, and often that associated dismantling of funding, the local state really is the lifeblood of populism and represents one of the only spaces for local citizens to affect real change, to be elected, to be listened to, taken seriously. So in some places where we might see that erosion and dismantling of the local state associated with populism, we may also see a renaissance of that importance of the local state as a place for political engagement, yet potentially for only permitted only for certain residents who subscribe to that specific vision of localism and the specific vision for the protection of place that populist reactionary movements envision.
Wonderful. Thank you, Harriet. So I think we're moving nicely into the next theme or question, which is around, I suppose, how you can change the state or change the state from the outside, or this idea of, which is obviously very prominent in the literature, how do social movements or how should social movements or citizens, community groups, engage with the state strategically? There's very different ideas in terms of close engagement, trying to become part of the state, almost build a regime with the state, and then there's a kind of a very different perspective where you stand back from, try to create your own kind of world outside of the state. I mean, I don't know how well that will fit with some of the UK research, but just thinking more generally, perhaps also more historically and theoretically, Crispin, what are the kind of potentials and limits of these different approaches to dealing with the state?
Yeah, I mean, obviously within the UK, a heavily centralized state, one of the things that we can sometimes fall vulnerable to is overemphasizing the particular rather than universal. So a way to flip the question is, for us is, and for me generally, both within the state but beyond the state, why has there been such a lack of mobilization and contestation? What is going on that has hindered, particularly in relation to austerity, but also more so with council tax, why there hasn't been mass mobilization? So if you think about council tax, it's, while the principles are very different to the poll tax, which caused mass riots and protests, it is far more aggressive. It's caused far more damage than the poll tax ever did, even though it was very short term, but probably would have, not least because council tax is so legitimized, so it's even more dangerous. So it gets us to that issue of what can be done by social movements. And if we go back to the particular again, there are instances in Manchester, Bristol, Brighton, where ACORN, which is a social movement, and Debt Justice have been able to mobilize, get a reasonable number of quite effective people together, lobbying the councils, where they've then reversed the use of debt enforcers, reduce the level at which point people are being pursued. So there are examples where it can happen. I think for me, theoretically, it takes us back to Clive Barnett's work, which obviously builds upon Dewey and a lot of others, where it's about those situated contexts. It's about, you know, the life worlds of those individuals. It's about the development of moral grammars, of, you know, the experience of being harmed, the experience of being disrespected and injured. And obviously something like council tax has a direct impact upon the physiology of the individual through poverty. And it's about that ability for individuals to learn. And as Barnett talks about, this ability to learn about how they're being affected, and then to identify with others, to identify how it fits with their everyday routines. You know, so going to the food bank, which can become legitimized, yet, you know, in a Barnett perspective, it's about learning that this is abnormal and it's a detrimental effect. So it's about that, you know, for social movements, I suppose it's about a very localized perspective. And I think the successes of ACORN and Debt Justice tell us that if the local state is so heterogeneous, that it's situated within particular contexts, that we see such variability, therefore it's the case that they've got to work through that type of life world, that it's about these situated contexts. It's about bringing communities together that are affected, assisting them in learning about how they are being affected, how it's a common issue locally, how they can communicate and interact with state officials to have these moral registers, to say to councils, look, this is having a mass detrimental impact. And while there aren't protests on the street, behind closed doors, vast numbers of people are being affected. You know, if there is a way forward, then I think there's a lot to be said from the work of Clive Barnett, but also others like you, Ross, in, you know, in terms of, you know, and Christina Temenos, Warren Magnuson, etc.
Thank you, Christine. Harriet, you wanted to come in there, so I saw.
Yeah, I just thought it was really interesting with in the topic of council tax, where you haven't seen a lot of these social movements rising up. Are you seeing any examples of kind of small acts and small levels of resistance? The reason why I ask is because I read a really interesting article this weekend, popular article, about a man who had racked up hundreds of thousands of council tax debts and was running a snail farm business, where he put snail farms in, he offered to landlords with business properties to put snail farms in their vacant properties to kind of escape from council tax on vacant business properties. And I wonder if any of you saw that article or that interesting piece, or had any other examples of these sort of small acts of resistance.
There is a loose grouping of individuals called the Freemen of the Land, who are quite interesting. And it's an interesting take. And it takes us to another dimension of what we mean by resistance, because these individuals are, they propagate through Facebook, Reddit, and other social media, where they talk about the Magna Carta and other very ancient legal precedences, to argue that they shouldn't have to pay council tax. Now, the interesting dimension to it is, so then it's very localized within their responses. I mean, you know, we have evidence of these local groupings, but it's interesting in the sense that they are acting on behalf of themselves, that they should not be obliged to pay tax, which is very different to other forms of resistance that we see, like ACORN and Debt Justice, where it's about social responsibility and the impacts upon broader communities. Theo, do you want to add a bit more to this about local resistance?
I don't have much to say about the snails, but the that's an interesting entrepreneurial take on tax resistance that I haven't heard of. But I think it's interesting the forms of like critique and resistance. Certainly, Yeah, I agree with Chris was saying that it's very limited, considering what like the overall like landscape of council tax debt. Going back to the sort of the discussion about the topological aspects of the local state, you know, the Acorn, part of their sort of strategy is to around council tax debt, around their kind of critique of the, how the local state is using debt and enforcement, is to try and set up bailiff-free zones, kind of neighbourhoods where bailiffs can't kind of function, can't doorstep debtors, basically. And that's kind of interesting because on the one hand, that's clearly a kind of part of a wider strategy of building, you know, building, you know, community solidarity. It's not just about the actual preventing, you know, bailiffs from operating. But from our research, and I think, you know, from doing this research in terms of, I mean, Kristen's been interviewing bailiff companies, enforcement firms, is that the business model has changed. Like it costs them a lot of money to send people out to doorstep debtors. They'd rather, you know, harass them with text messages and emails and letters. So they don't actually have to be in the space, you know, they don't have to be on your doorstep to have the effect against people who are on who are in debt. And the other thing is they don't, that the even like taking control of goods and this whole kind of process that is obviously what the bailiffs kind of threaten to do when you're in council tax debt, that even isn't a kind of necessarily a kind of an economic option for them. It rarely gets all the way to that point, according to sort of debt advisors that I've interviewed. So it nonetheless still has the effect. And I think that's kind of interesting from the perspective of organizing, trying to create those autonomous spaces, build that autonomy and build this kind of resistance. I mean, to a certain extent, I wonder whether certain groups kind of have misconceptualized the sort of, yeah, the topological form of the state, in the sense that they think that this can be kind of dealt with through a kind of frontal attack or whatever, but actually perhaps it can't be in the same way. I don't know what the solution is to that, but I think it's very interesting. How the different kind of concepts of fiscal space kind of collide, and maybe it's part of the explanation of where the lack of resistance to this tax system.
Yes, it's really interesting. So I just wanted to say, well, I was just thinking of one example. I remember in the early 90s, working in cafes and stuff at restaurants in the summer, there were lots of people who were working there who were basically gone off grid because of the tax system, because they refused to pay the poll tax, this tax that was implemented in the early 90s. And that seemed to be possible in that period. At least it seemed that there were people who were doing it and they were still getting their pay slips somehow. And I imagine in the current system, and certainly since then, it's very hard to escape the reach of the state. You know, exactly what you're saying, the state, this presence of the state, it does need to turn up on your doorstep. It's in your mobile phone. It's sending you emails. That closeness to what you're doing is very different. It's changed quite dramatically in 20 or 30 years.
Yeah. So I just wanted to add that just on that point, Ross, an interesting thing about so we were lucky enough to get into these debt enforcement firms. And the business model is one in which, you know, to make money, they now collect vast amounts of data on individuals, and the state is essentially outsourcing the monitoring of these individuals. The local state is. So they pay these debt enforcement firms because the debt enforcement firms are able to track the individual, you know, work, you know, whatever data they can get hold of on the individual. And they're able to track these individuals year after year. And as Theo says, they don't need to go to the doorstep, and they won't, because it's very costly, because they're all in competition with each other, but they're able to use social media and the knowledge they have on these individuals. So, you know, it takes us back to like people like Langley, etc., and the financialization of the individual in private finance is now happening in the public sector and the financial obligations.
Yeah, that is definitely enough scope there for another podcast or two, I think, that reach of the stake. Harry, I wanted to come back to you, and you already had mentioned, thought about different kinds of movements, not necessarily progressive movements, in relation to the state. I wondered if you could add something from kind of reflecting on this positionality of movements. For what you were saying, it sounded very much like they were engaging very much with the state and trying to become part of the state. And have you come across anything where more progressive movements, perhaps, or perhaps more authoritarian movements at the same time, are trying to position themselves beyond and away from the state and not directed towards the state?
It's interesting. The reason I'm attracted particularly to this question of talking about between progressive transformation and authoritarian takeover is I find it very hard to place the populist types of movements that I look at. They belong somewhere on the scale in the middle. They really are in the in-between, in their combination of all different types of sometimes contradictory political standpoints. So you can see new reactionary parties that align with existing right-wing factions. They blend resistance to specific urban development or infrastructure initiatives with broader nationalist, anti-immigration, conservative protectionist sentiments. But this is all packaged there in the cases that I've looked at in Sweden, alongside calls to re-democratize local government, to return power to the people. And this makes it really quite hard to capture and to comprehend, because it doesn't really fit into the neat categories or binaries that we often apply when we're thinking about trying to conceptualize futures for government and the local state. I have two cases in particular that I've been looking at the moment. And in the first case, the small town I mentioned, there what began as a kind of populist pushback against an infrastructural populism, we could call it, against a specific urban development and the introduction of kind of new transport infrastructure, became political parties, which became a kind of right-wing coalition populist government. But I've also got another case study, which is Uppsala, which is a bigger city. And actually there, the form of populist resistance that I'm seeing still is in the form of a social movement. It's not a political regime that has taken over. It's more of an uprising that is beginning to very much influence the oppositional party's agenda ahead of the 2026 local elections that will happen this year. All of the right-wing parties are kind of jumping on board with this populist resistance movement as always a way to kind of to get votes and to align with what they're seeing as the public interest ahead of those elections. And this movement in particular at the moment are mobilizing around a specific tram that's being built in the city, and we see that the mobilizing of these specific groups adopting again these kind of localist populist imaginaries of you're the elites, you shouldn't decide, and we are the locals. And I think it's really interesting because in planning, when we talk about the power of social movements, we talk about the idea of new prefigurative politics, and that's to use Zimin Davoudi's term. And the problem is with these populist movements, even if they blend different things along the political scale, they represent a new prefigurative politics. It's a new vision. It's a new way of doing things. And often it's directly in pushback to neoliberalized, urbanized, market-led urbanization regimes. So it is giving us a new vision or a new idea and pushing back against our institutionalized values. It's just maybe not the prefigurative politics we wanted to see. I think a lot can be learned with how these types of particular social movements are mobilizing public interest and developing new visions, new values as part of their political program. And a lot to be learned about how that is being done and how those votes are being mobilized. But a huge danger, because I mean, populism has been frequently referred to as a weak ideology. It's awfully capturable by other more powerful regimes, such as authoritarian ideologies. I mean, that is where it can really be in its dangers, because populism's great as a pushback. Populism's great as a point of which to mobilize against something. But it's really bad when it comes to ideas and doesn't have a particularly good policy platform, a set of programs. It's not so proactive. It's mostly reactive, which means it's really subject to capturing and merging with other more dominant political trends and political ideologies that either being in its authoritarian forms or merging with other more neoliberal ideologies to create something more business as usual. So there's both things to be learned and considerable dangers there. I don't know if that answered your question, but I talked about what I wanted to talk about.
Well, that's also really important. So it was certainly interesting, and we learned a lot from you talking. And as we move towards the end of the podcast, I'll just follow up with you, Harry. I mean, you've already started talking a bit about what needs to be researched or what should be researched. What constitutes the most important areas of research on the local state? What are the most urgent issues? What should scholars of many disciplines be thinking about researching in the coming years?
Good question. I think I might, again, go back to something that Crispian said, and that was about when we discussed these ideas of small acts of protest against these the council tax debts versus kind of these larger social responsibility acts. And you conceptualize those small acts of resistance often being more on individuals acting on behalf of themselves compared to the other movements which could be concerned more with social responsibility. But I think it's quite important as researchers, we don't underestimate, and there's a risk we can underestimate, the effective power of individual grievances when they become a collective. And that's what I see a lot of in the cases that I'm talking about. And I'm no expert on council tax or resistance to council tax for that matter. But I certainly see in my cases a lot of individuals coming together with specific grievances against infrastructure projects, both social and technical infrastructure projects, who come together and find unity in their individual grievances. And as part of these social movements, aren't necessarily working towards some kind of social responsibility, but nevertheless still have the power, as I've seen in my small case study in Knivsta, to completely take over government, to completely redefine the local state, its values and institutions. So I think it's important that we continue to follow both of those, like those large acts of what we'd see as more progressive social responsibility oriented, and these kind of small acts that can come together with what we could consider more regressive or more individual selfish based ways of pushback that actually can be quite powerful when they are collected together. Following that, I suppose I'd like to see more comparative research on populist and authoritarian right wing governments, how they build on reactionary politics, how they seek to challenge the different fiscal practices and neoliberal rationalities that have dominated so much over the last 20, 30 years across different countries. So I'm really interested in where we can compare countries like Sweden and the UK, which I suppose we've been trying to do a little bit today, but also beyond, how authoritarian or populist regimes play out in practice when they get and take over government. We briefly touched on kind of the topic of reform, and interesting to watch what is happening in some local states in the UK, where actually a lot of unexperienced politicians come into practice and have all these ideas of bringing in more austerity, but then it comes into a lot in conflict with kind of how local government actually works and their responsibilities, and the already extremely cut back austerity destroyed local state which they come into. And I think that would be really interesting to read about. And when I think I would just, on probably a methodological level, I'd really like to see more research that maybe didn't look at these changes to the local state only from the outside, but spent time within the local state. I mean, experiencing those changes firsthand, experiencing how professionals working within the local state and in local government respond to, interact with, and deal with the change in politics. I think there's a lot of inspiration to be found in ethnographic oriented planning research. I read a great paper recently about the simple power of tea drinking as an ethnographic practice in local government studies, sitting there and drinking cups of tea with the people experiencing huge changes as part of the local state. And I think we can all take inspiration from this type of research. Thank you.
Absolutely. Thank you, Harriet. Theo, where do you see the most important issues, research issues on this topic?
I think the fiscal space and the fiscal imagination is sort of conceptual focus to understand what's happening within the local state. Oh, and its relationship, obviously, with central states. Obviously, you know, on the one hand, how the sort of spatial relations behind how the local state essentially pays for itself and how that is changing. And then at the same time, how that's being represented. How do people think about themselves within a sort of fiscal geography? How do they locate themselves against others? You know, are they contributors? Do they see themselves or others as contributors? I think this relationship between fiscal space and its representation is how the kind of fiscal regimes obviously endure and will determine what will be the limit to the next kind of, you know, reformulation of fiscal states. I think in the context obviously of populism, you know, it's about who's put in on the side of being a sponger or an alien. And then in the context of devolution, you know, which is obviously being kind of discussed here in the UK, it will be, you know, do these local states, do they have that political capital to extract more from their regions, and what kind of pressures will they be put under to sort of articulate, you know, where your money goes locally? For example, I was doing this interview once recently with a councillor who told me that they're trying to reform proof their local authority by trying to do as much, like, obviously visual stuff within the local authority, planting lots of gardens and cleaning up lots of rubbish. So the presentation of where people's money goes becomes suddenly very important. And I think, yeah, so fiscal space, the fiscal imagination, I think a conceptual focus that I think could be really, is really important at the moment. And actually what Chris was saying earlier about the sort of work by the sort of like labour geographies, the sort of front, what is the experience of the front line and the back office within local authorities day to day? I think I'd be very interested to read more about that. Yeah, I think especially actually around the sort of fiscal and the financial work, the tax work and the finance work, which I think is often not kind of considered. It hasn't, I think, historically been a researched area in terms of the working lives of civil servants and people who work in the local government.
Thank you, Theo. Crispian, where do you see the most important issues or most urgent issues of future research being?
That's great. Thanks, Ross. I mean, just firstly, methodologically, building upon what Harriet said, that there's a tremendous amount to be said for the importance of ethnographic work if it can be done. Obviously, it is immensely challenging, but, you know, if you look at organizational theory, critical management studies, some of the stuff then there, particularly on social movements, brings tremendous insight. You know, just another example, building from what Harriet said, you know, the importance of things like cynicism around the water cooler or in the kitchen, you know, has been shown in studies to be so critical for the way that the organization continues, how the top down is able to be implemented, because people don't question it. They work through cynicism. And it's it's things like that that we've not had a tremendous insight into. And I know it's immensely challenging. You know, I've tried myself with local government and it's immensely challenging, but I think we can take some inspiration from, there's an area of corporate anthropology where somehow they're able to get inside corporations for very brief moments, but for those very brief moments, the insights are tremendous. So I think there's a lot to be said that, you know, methodologically. Another insight is I think we need to try and not fall into the gap of the particular over the universal. So we often see studies that are very interesting on particular things at particular points in time and particular spaces, but less on the universal. And I think for that, a major area for me is about why we see, obviously, the state evolves, it's performed constantly, it changes, but at the same time, there's a great deal of continuity. There's that fiscal coherence. And I think that's an area that we need to investigate. How does the state carry on? And Theo mentioned it around, you know, fiscal imaginaries and things like that. But I think it's a key area that we need to be examining, where we are in a stage of mature austerity, where the state continues and the authoritarian elements of the state carry on and persist. As well as that, we've got the issue of the topological versus the topographical state, you know, the difference between territoriality and scalar forms, but at the same time, the state increasingly impinging upon the existence of citizens through connectivity and social distance in ways that we've not seen before. So I think that's another important aspect to that. But within all of this, you know, and there's some interesting stuff done now around state capacities, the fact that the state is able to develop these very top-down legal parameters, but in terms of ensuring that the local state actually fully implements those, there's a question around the extent to which they do have the state capacities in which to direct. And I think there's an important rebalancing of, you know, ensuring that we don't just assume that there is authoritarianism, that it's just top down, because I think there's plenty of evidence to show, and within the council tax system, and we need to bring this out, that central government doesn't necessarily have the full capacities in which to ensure that the local state is delivering in ways that central government would want. And I think we need to be exploring that, because it is evident. And it, you know, it's not new. You know, there's been plenty of studies done on this in the past, you know, inspired by people like Bob Jessop and Gramscian thinking, that tell us that that isn't the case. There's also the issue of the increasingly unbounded nature of the state. This has been going on for a long time, but I think in the present time, and particularly in relation to council tax, we're seeing an acceleration of that, the increasingly important role of the private sector, supplementing, replacing, reinforcing the role of the state in the delivery of its functions, in the fulfillment of its aims. And then finally, just building upon what Harriet was talking about, there is an interesting issue about the rise of the right, particularly in the UK. We've got local government elections coming up in May, but we already know that the councils that they run, and Harriet said this, Ross as well, that they've come in and all of a sudden they realise that they can't do lots of things, or they don't exactly know what to do. And they're cutting services. We already know that they're increasing the council tax in these places. So I think there is a need for a thorough investigation, that it's not just this is the rise of the right, this is reform, this is a right-wing agenda, but they get into local state and all of a sudden all those antagonisms, those contradictions and tensions come through. And it would be interesting to see, and we should examine the extent to which they are able to and they want to implement right-wing initiatives, because I think it's going to be far messier than what people assume.
Yeah, wonderful. Thank you, Crispian, Theo, Harriet. It's been a really rich discussion. I've learned a lot. Things are changing all the time, and apparently staying the same in relation to the state is usually complex. And I think it was a wonderful introduction to the series of podcasts. And I thank you very much for your time. And to close the podcast, I'll hand over to Matthias and Gala to tell us what's coming up in the next one.
Wonderful. Thanks, Russ. Thanks to Debruth. That was really fascinating listening to your thoughts on the changing forms of the local state. We sort of centered this conversation around more authoritarian, far-right transformations, and are going to use the next episode to sort of look at progressive transformations and potentials in local state formations. We'll be thinking about state-civil society alliances and how they're shifting, how they're changing. We'll be thinking about questions of scale as well, which we was briefly mentioned today as well. And also, again, on questions around or outside of the state, which, Matthias, you want to say a couple of words?
Yeah, because I think your great ideas, which you shared today, are going far beyond the scope of the next episode of the podcast. For example, the question of social movements and the question, what happens when actors of social movements eventually become the local state, if there are changes or transformations between social movements and the local state, or even also limits of social movements. And another important issue is to think about university or research institutions as state institutions in terms of austerity, in terms of rationalities of governmentality, which is also taking place very directly in university and higher education institutions. And I think the third issue, Crispian mentioned it, it's about, yes, social practices and everyday practices, which are also very important for materializing local statehood. And I think it's important to go far beyond the usual suspects and to think about what happens in the local sports club, the school board, or allotment gardens in terms of the change of the local state. And these are questions we hope to discuss in the next episode or in hopefully in future research. But first of all, thanks to all of you for sharing your ideas.
Thanks to you for listening.
For more information, visit our website urbanpolitical.podigy.io.